Welcome back to Food Toxicology. Well, among toxicologists and risk assessors, there is no word in the toxicology lexicon, perhaps, that gives more concern, perhaps, than the D word, dioxin. When dioxin is mentioned in the course of a risk assessment, risk management, there's great concern not only because of the incredible costs associated with dioxin management, but the potential that we just don't know the lower limits of impact of dioxins on human health. To give you an example, I was involved in a risk assessment in Northern California in the early 1980s. Dioxins can be produced from the combustion of chlorinated hydrocarbon materials, and in this particular case it was a fence post treating wood treatment plant that was burned. The plume of potential dioxins, again, which form from these high temperature combustion events in this case, went down a particular airshed, and there was great concern in terms of public health authorities on contamination of dioxin in food and feedstuffs to the local resident populations, especially those that used home-produced foods and livestock. The incident concerned many local residents, and in terms of risk communication, it was a challenge to convey the sense of risk associated with dioxins, but to do it in a responsible fashion. Despite all challenges, there was a tremendous amount of local concern, and one of the public leaders of that local concern actually passed away due to a heart attack while going up the steps to the courthouse to one of the public meetings. Did dioxin end up killing this particular woman? I would say yes, in a certain sense, only from the fear of intoxication associated with dioxins. This fear in the general public has actually stimulated a tremendous amount of concern with public health authorities. One of the byproducts of that concern was a 2003 study by the National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine, dioxins and dioxin-like compounds in the food supply. What we're going to do today in this lecture is review dioxin-related compounds in the entire human food chain to give you a broad-based understanding of what we know in terms of the sources, pathways, receptors, and controls of dioxins in the human food chain. Our learning objectives here today, what we're going to try to do is explore some dioxins and dioxin-like compounds in the food supply. As you'll see, there are other types of chlorinated hydrocarbons, dioxin-like compounds, if you will, that have similar manifestations of clinical diagnostic endpoints. We'll try to summarize the structural similarity of the cogeners of dioxins and furans, the chemical structures of all of the polychlorinated moieties associated with this class of chemical compounds. We'll understand as well, or try to understand, how risk assessors and scientists have actually tried to reduce that complexity by coming up with a system of TEFs, or toxicity equivalency factors, for this full range of dioxin-like compounds. These toxicity equivalency factors give rise to toxicity equivalence in terms of a risk assessment approach for this class of compounds. We'll try to summarize some of the known processes and toxicological endpoints of dioxin exposure. Dioxin exposure at high levels in terms of acute and chronic, or low level, very low level in some cases, exposure via food. We'll try to describe a little bit the controversy and the data needs surrounding low level dioxin exposure. When we have larger exposures, higher level exposures, and acute presentation, the dose response is quite clear. When we have very low level, the dose response and the clinical progression to disease is less clear. We'll describe some of the observed effects and some of the major findings associated with animal studies with dioxin. We'll try to summarize in a very broad way the environmental and food sources of dioxins. We'll try to summarize as well some of the known human risk estimations for dioxins and some of the regulatory control approaches for dioxin exposure. Well, dioxins are a part of the organochlorine legacy that we have had in industrialized societies since before World War II. One of the reasons these compounds form a legacy is that they are very stable in the environment. These compounds can be formed not only by synthetic means, such as DDT, the insecticide, but it also can be formed from combustion processes and naturally occurring processes in the presence of chlorine. So not everything is a synthetic pathway, and in fact, research has shown that some chlorinated compounds naturally occurring and microbial action can actually produce natural dioxins. These compounds are often nonpolar and therefore highly lipophilic. They have the ability to be sequestered then in fat tissue. As we know from our adsorption, distribution, transport, and storage lectures, this can demonstrate bioaccumulation up the food chain. We get continuously exposed because these compounds, with their stability and their sequestration in fats, allow them to circulate in the liposphere. In other words, as an animal eats a plant or another animal that has some level of fat, there will be the presentation of some of these organochlorines in terms of the cycle. And until we break that cycle in terms of production and release of these chemicals, we will continue to have some level of these organochlorines in fats. These compounds are related to, in terms of their clinical presentation of disease, immune dysfunction, neurological effects, cancer, endocrine disruption, and some other toxicological endpoints. These compounds are all around us, and again, natural as well as man-made or synthetic sources, as well as the metabolic breakdown products. For example, your body fat contains primarily the metabolic DDE form of DDT. Sometimes the effects of low-level exposure are subclinical and at the biomolecular level, and this is complicating in terms of the risk assessment of very low-level exposure that we can see in food. This is a non-acute, chronic, low-level exposure. Now again, this is the citation for the 2003 National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine analysis, dioxin and dioxin-like compounds in the food supply. This particular report was a very in-depth analysis, not only of what we know in terms of 2003 about dioxins, but what we need to know in terms of research objectives, and as well precautionary practices that we need to start applying in terms of minimizing dioxin exposures, especially to certain subpopulations. Some of the results of this report indicate that there is widespread low-level contamination of animal feeds and the human food supply in terms of dioxin contamination. Animal fats are primarily considered to be the vector of exposure of dioxins in terms of humans. These compounds metabolize slowly and therefore accumulate in the body fat over a lifetime. We do know that regulatory pressure has shown a decline in levels in humans and in the environment. So this is kind of a good cause effect in terms of enhanced environmental regulation about the release of dioxins and dioxin-like substances. Endocrine disruption is a primary concern in terms of developmental toxicity, and as is exposure in children's health and development as a broad-based issue related to dioxins. There is a high public priority from the National Academy's report to reduce dioxin levels, especially in girls and young women prior to the reproductive stage in their lives. In terms of food supply exposure, this report confirms that we have dioxins in animal production systems. This is due primarily to airborne deposition, and again from incineration sources as a prime vector. And this happens on grazing areas and water bodies, perhaps associated with fish farming. There is some geographic variability in terms of environmental contamination. However, this variability is diluted out via the food distribution system for the broad U.S. food system and human impact. In terms of human foods, we have, therefore, relatively uniform exposure across our population. There is some concern about food consumption patterns. For example, subsistence livers that, or individuals that eat a more local food supply that might come from a more contaminated environment in terms of atmospheric deposition. However, the largest concern are for individuals who have high-fat diets. The high-fat diet will contain a larger dioxin load, therefore higher exposure to dioxins. The animal fats of interest are just plain meat fat, full-fat dairy products, and fatty fish in terms of some of the problematic consumption patterns. This next slide shows the structure of dioxins. This is 2378 TCDD, or tetrachlorodibenzoparadioxin. This particular compound, TCDD, it's a good idea to kind of focus on this structure a little bit because this is the primary chemical structure that all other dioxins, and there are many in terms of polychlorinated forms of this chemical, but all of these have toxicity equivalents related back to this particular structure, TCDD. So we talk about toxicity equivalency factors and toxicity equivalents. We are relating other cogeners back to TCDD. The other cogeners can look like the various polychlorinated dibenzodioxins, and you can see on this structure where there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 various places for chlorination, or in some cases, due to microbial action in the environment, dechlorination. All of these have a potential equivalent, but this gives us numerous types of dioxin cogeners. There's also a class of compounds referred to as chlorinated dibenzofurans. The furan is different in that it's a five-membered ring in the center of this three-membered ring molecule. And this one is 2378 tetrachlorodibenzofuran. One of the problems associated with dioxins and furan-type molecules is because of their structure, they're actually flat molecules. They actually have a very similar electron distribution and shape and size to chemical compounds like estradiol, and scientists theorize that this is why we observe estrogenic effects with some of these chlorinated polycyclic compounds. Another category of chlorinated polycyclic compound is the polychlorinated biphenyls, better known as PCBs. These are industrial chemicals. They were used because of their dielectric properties in many industrial applications in terms of high power applications, transformers on telephone poles back in the 50s and the 60s and to a degree in the 70s contained PCBs. They were thought to be wonderful substances. We did not know at that time that in fact PCBs had a very, very large, long residual time in the environment and had the toxicity that we now understand they have. This one is 3,3', 4,4', 5,5' hexachlorobiphenyl. Now, in terms of the full range of dioxins, we find 75 dioxin cogeners and 135 dibenzofuran cogeners. These are where we can have various combinations of chlorination on these molecules. Remember also that in terms of the broader range of halogenated chemical compounds, we can also see polybrominated species. And we've spoken in here in one case study of the incident of a PPB, a polybrominated biphenyl fire retardant, getting mixed up in an animal feed supplement and actually poisoning thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of food animals in the Midwest about a decade and a half ago. In general, the dioxins and the dibenzofurans are present in human adipose tissue and in fish and bird samples at about the submicrogram per kilogram or the subpart per billion level. So we're talking parts per trillion levels. Many of the compounds, because it presents as an array of compounds, and this is presents a degree of complexity in terms of the risk assessment, because we're not dealing with one cogener, we're dealing with a spectrum of cogeners in terms of the amount of chlorination, each one of those having a different toxicologic profile. In general, among the major categories, the chlorinated benzodioxins are greater in terms of relative toxicity from the dibenzofurans, which is much, much greater in toxicity than the PCBs or just the chlorinated naphthalenes, another category of chlorinated hydrocarbons. One of the approaches in terms of risk management and risk assessment is to combine the various risks from dioxins because they do share a common mechanism of toxicity. The way we have approached that is to establish toxicity equivalency factors, or TEFs, to compare the different toxicity of the different dioxin compounds. One chlorine, two chlorine, three chlorine, four chlorines, and we can come up with these relative risk levels. The TEFs are expressed in terms of toxicity equivalence, or TEQs. I'll show you in the next slide how that is done. The TEQ then is the amount, the relative amount, because we use TCDD, tetrachlorodibenzodioxin, 2,3,7,8. We use that particular cogener as the standard of comparison. So if one of the other cogeners, one of the other molecules, is a half or a quarter or a tenth of toxic, the toxicity equivalency will magnify in terms of a risk assessment as one-tenth of the concentration of TCDD. The way we break that out in terms of a scheme is shown on this table. The TEFs in terms of the toxicity equivalency factors, again, if we're comparing two chemicals side by side and one is one-tenth as toxic as TCDD, such as chemical like hexachlorodibenzofuran, what we do is we actually come up with a toxicity equivalency factor. And so since everything is going to be compared to TCDD, that gives a 1.0 toxicity. So if in our analysis of a food product, we're breaking down all the different species, the amount of TCDD is going to be magnified by, multiplied by one. Whereas, for example, some of the different polychlorinated benzodioxins, so for instance, here's a fully chlorinated octachlorodibenzodioxin, this has substantially less toxicity, a thousandfold less toxicity, and so the equivalency factor is 0.001. This allows us to do a more quantitative assessment of risk of food types, environmental contamination, and progression throughout the food system. We can use this information in terms of toxicity equivalence and toxicity equivalency factors in terms of comparing relative risk. One of the inputs in terms of looking at relative risk is to do a background analysis of what our body burden levels for dioxins are. This is a relatively complex graphic. It's going to take you a few minutes to kind of chunk through the amount of data that's in this, but in essence, this is a historical representation of dioxin body burden levels throughout some major dioxin exposure incidences and as well, what's the norm in terms of the U.S. population recently and a decade ago. If we actually look at this graphic, we have the various categories of the case studies. We have the median actually in a, as a white bar, the contribution of 2,3,7,8 tetrachlorodibenzodioxin is shown as a light blue, whereas the non-TCDD equivalence is shown in a green. But this is, gives you the entire range here, and that range is the body burden in nanograms per kilogram for body weight for 25 normalized for 25% lipid. The concentration units here, because it's a log scale, 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000, and these are again are nanograms per kilogram or part per trillion. In terms of going across here, there's several episodes. We'll talk a little bit about each one of these episodes. The most recent review by CDC in the year 2000 gives a median number, an average mean number, I'm sorry, of 7 in terms of body burden levels. In 1990, across the USA, it was actually substantially higher. I believe that was around 18. And so the regulatory efforts between 1990 and the year 2000 have succeeded in drawing this number down, is the popular conclusion among regulatory agencies. The next categories, next three categories are, four categories are from an incident in Seveso, Italy. We'll review in terms of an industrial explosion and incineration from a pesticide factory that contaminated the airshed of a local population in Seveso, Italy. There was a significant amount of follow-up analysis in terms of how far individuals were from the incident and their dose and their presentation of some disease, such as cancer. You'll see that some of the highest concentrations that were observed in terms of body lipid levels, 1,400 parts per trillion or 14 parts per billion. This is extremely large in the liturgy of dioxins. The next two are from Operation Ranch Hand, from individuals that were in low exposure or high exposure categories. Operation Ranch Hand is also known as Agent Orange during the Vietnam War. These are soldiers that were exposed to dioxins because of manufacturing byproducts with some herbicides they were using to defoliate parts of the jungle during the Vietnam War. The final three categories are from another industrial accident with BASF in Germany in terms of very high levels of exposure as well and some of the body burdens associated with dioxins. These case studies actually do provide us with some not only clinical history but the ability to look at dioxin exposure and presentation of disease in the individuals that have been exposed. In the United States, we had an incident in northern New York with a hazardous waste landfill called Love Canal. This was in the 40s to the 1950s. This was before we had the EPA and before we had real knowledge of the proper ways to dispose of and manage hazardous waste. Hooker Chemical Company used this area as a hazardous waste dump. It was a landfill, and so they dumped their industrial waste and then filled it over with dirt. They actually donated the land to the local school district. There were houses nearby with contaminated basements over the years following. It was shut down as a major Superfund site. It's a demonstration, perhaps, of what not to do in terms of hazardous waste management. In 1982, there was an incident in Times Beach, Missouri, where a chemical mixture was used to oil the streets and the gravel as a dust abatement measure. These oils, unfortunately, contained various levels of dioxin, dioxin-like compounds, contaminated this whole community because of the road and the dust. In essence, regulatory authorities and governmental entities ended up buying the town, closing it down, and remediating the entire small community. In the 60s and 70s, Agent Orange presented as a vector of dioxin contamination from soldiers involved in Operation Ranch Hand. Again, in 1976, Seveso, Italy, there was an industrial accident and a fire associated with a chemical facility manufacturing 2,4,5 trichlorophenol. This particular fire actually contaminated, again, a significant geographical area and population. There have been numerous follow-up analyses in terms of, for example, fertility and cancer impacts, reproductive success, and full consortia of clinical diagnostic endpoints. In 1953, there was a BASF fire with chlorinated herbicide manufacturing workers, and again, an opportunity for clinical analysis of dioxins in human exposure. In terms of the United States in recent times, in 1995-1997 time period, CDC and EPA did a significant amount of analysis in terms of establishing baseline levels of contamination dioxin in the U.S. population. The average adult background intake was estimated to be 70 picograms TEQs, toxicity equivalents of dioxins and furans per day as a cumulative of these particular types of compounds. In terms of the serum levels, the TEQ had a mean of 22, and if you broke it out as just specifically 2,3,7,8, the most toxic cogener, we found a mean level of 2.1 picograms per gram of lipid. In terms of dioxin toxicity, EPA has characterized TCDD as a human carcinogen. Other dioxins are characterized as likely human carcinogens. So when we talk about dioxin carcinogenicity, we are typically talking and referring about TCDD's known carcinogenesis. TCDD equivalents give us a relative risk of that. Dioxins can alter the fundamental growth and development of cells, and so it's in these cellular level and metabolic level toxic endpoints that we have some concern. The impact on cells includes adverse effect for reproduction and development at a cellular level. There's appears to be some suppression of the immune system. And in high-dose instances, we have the observation of chloracne, and this is a severe acne-like condition. In one of our introductory lectures, I showed you the picture of an acute dioxin poisoning of Viktor Yushchenko. This was a few years back during the Ukrainian presidential campaign. This individual was perhaps a dynamic and one might regard as a good-looking candidate, and he was severely disfigured due to poisoning that has been attributed to forces perhaps of political opponents, an unfortunate situation indeed for this individual. Probably this was an acute dose delivered in a fatty food product or an alcoholic beverage. In terms of dioxin exposure, we know that they're highly persistent and they can bioaccumulate, so this gives us an idea of trying to manage them. 95% of our dioxin intake comes through dietary animal fats. We have some low exposure from breathing air that contains trace amounts of dioxins. If you're in an airshed impacted typically by incinerations or incinerators, there can be ingestion of soil containing dioxins or crops grown in soils containing large amounts of dioxins. We can have some amount of absorption because of the lipophilic nature of the compound through contact with air, soil, or water containing these trace levels. There are some environmental processes that will result in low-level exposure of the general population. But because of regulatory pressure and change in practices in several industries, dioxin levels in the U.S. environment have declined since the 1970s. There is still some concern in terms of the global transport, the hopping, if you will, because atmospheric deposition does not know boundaries. These transboundary concerns, and primarily in developing nations and nations that have enhanced or increased amount of incineration and combustion processes and a very large population, for instance, India and China. The economic development associated with these countries has some individuals concerned about the safety of the global food supply. The dioxin emissions in the United States have decreased by about 80% due to regulatory efforts between 1987 and 1995, a decade's worth of exposure. In terms of the general population body burden of dibenzodioxins and dibenzofurans, we find that the range is about 8.5 picograms of toxic equivalents per gram of lipid at the low end to about 50 picograms TEQs at the high range for dioxin furans. And so significant range. In terms of the mean, it's about 21.1 picograms via the National Academy of Sciences 2003 study. The U.S. estimate in terms of dioxins and dibenzofurans estimate that in terms of our dietary intake, it's about 41 picograms of toxicity equivalents per day, or 0.59 picograms of TEQs per kilogram body weight per day. In terms of the estimate, that allows for, if you start including PCBs in that estimate in terms of the full range of these chlorinated aromatic hydrocarbons, it jumps up a bit to 65 picograms or 1 picogram TEQ per kilogram body weight per day. In children, because of the dietary changes in the ratio in terms of body weight to food consumed, it is a bit higher at 54 picograms per day or 3.6 picograms per kilogram body weight per day. Because of dietary changes and food consumption to body mass changes as children age, that does decrease with age. It's found in analysis that five compounds make up about 70% of the load of general population intake. This includes TCDD, the 2378 cogener, and also a pentachlorinated dibenzodioxin, a pentachlorinated dibenzofuran, hexachlorinated dibenzofuran, and PCB number 126 are the five principal compounds identified in terms of our intake of foods. Now, the dioxin effects in humans have a lot to do with what's found in terms of dose response, but we do find that the amount found in tissues of the U.S. population, our body burden, in terms of the analysis by experts in the field, that this does approach within a factor of 10 the level for adverse effects to occur. This gives you an idea of why there is such great concern about dioxin in the human food chain. However, there is no clear indication of increased disease in the general population, and so there is a limitation of current data and scientific tools for analyzing some of the metabolic processes, the cellular level processes that might have an impact. There might be some instances, for example, the actual impacts take decades, for example, carcinogenesis, or that the reproductive effects are dose response limited in terms of we can't look at a clear cause-effect relationship between dioxins and particular outcomes in human disease. In terms of the effects of humans, researchers find that there is a 1 to 100 or a 1 to 1,000 increased chance of experiencing cancer related to dioxin exposure in the general population. So when the risk assessment is done from in terms of known data, no effect levels, cancer slope levels. This is the result, 1 in 100 to 1 in 1,000 increased chance due to dioxin exposure. The cancer risk analysis in 2000 indicated that there was a tenfold higher chance of cancer. Excuse me. Than was estimated in a previous reassessment. So this results from knowing what levels are out there, but also knowing in terms of the dose response risk calculations associated with potential dioxin effects. New knowledge yields new risk assessment. In terms of some of the focus groups, children are one of them. Fetuses, infants, and children may be more sensitive to dioxin exposure because of their rapid growth. We have limited data on children, but just like with pesticides, they are developing organisms in terms of neurological growth development, and their reproductive systems are also developing. We still have a subpopulation of Air Force personnel exposed to Agent Orange during the Vietnam War, and how that might present in terms of clinical disease, and it's still under study by the Department of Defense decades later. There are some other subpopulations that have been exposed from industrial exposure or accidents, or individuals that have an unusually high consumption, and especially high fat foods or fish, meat, or dairy products that have high dioxin levels. There is a controversy associated with dioxin effects because we can, in the laboratory and in vitro analyses, observe enzyme induction and indicators of altered cellular function. This may or may not indicate a toxic response. It may just be a response of the biological system to presentation of a chemical. And so the question in terms of the controversy, is this just an adaptation of the biological system to the dose, the low dose of a chemical, or is this an indication of a chain of events leading to some sort of adverse effect? And this is problematic in terms of risk assessment because we are talking about managing dioxin levels at the part per trillion level. This is a very low concentration with very expensive laboratory analyses. One of the problems I introduced in terms of the D word is the cost of dioxin-based investigations. Sometimes full Kogener analyses for dioxins, the amount charged for an individual laboratory assay can exceed $1,000. That's $1,000 per data point. And so if you are reviewing a public health concern in a community or a contaminated area that perhaps is dealing with hundreds or more in terms of affected individuals or areas, the laboratory costs alone for dioxin related project can be significant. One of these was actually demonstrated recently in Belgium. We're going to do a quick case study here. You can do an internet search and find out more details about this. This was an unfortunate incident where a container truck that was used to transport oils had transported industrial oils, and some of these transformer oils contained dioxins and PCBs. It was then used to transport rendered oils and fats, waste products, for production, for transport as and manufacturing in animal feed at feed mills. So there was a significant contamination of the oil that went into this animal feed. Veterinarians at the time noticed reduction in egg hatchability, reduced weight gain, increased mortality. A syndrome that's extremely common with chlorinated hydrocarbons called chickadema. So there was a good diagnostician on hand, ataxia, or the inability to stand in these particular animals. So chlorinated hydrocarbon toxicity was diagnosed relatively early in the whole diagnostic toxicology processes. Follow-up investigation did show the contamination, and not only of the feed, but that at this point in time, of the food animals themselves. They found PCBs and dioxins in many animal products. About 60 million kilograms of animals needed to be destroyed because of this particular contamination incident. It affected not only Belgium, but some of the surrounding territory in terms of the food distribution network in the EEC. There was a meat product embargo as well. So this was extremely significant in terms of European food quality. In terms of the dioxins and PCBs analyzed in the feedstuffs, this gives you a graph of the log of the PCBs in micrograms per gram or parts per billion fat, 0 to 3. And on this axis, the dioxin concentration as well in picograms per gram of fat. And this is parts per trillion dioxin. This is parts per billion PCBs. And you can see that in terms of the contamination in the feedstuff, there was a very linear ratio of these two contaminants in terms of the contamination via this oil truck. How did that present in the food, the food quality itself? This is an analysis of chicken meat. Again, the same sort of axes. This is PCBs in part per billion, graphed against the dioxin levels. What you can see in terms of the fat is that we had a fairly conservative accumulation of what was in. We remember the previous graph, we had 1, 2, and 3 parts per billion, 1, 2, and 3 parts per trillion, respectively, in PCBs and dioxins. And we see that same sort of ratio and magnitude in terms of these chlorinated hydrocarbons in chicken fat as well. And so this represents a significant risk in terms of exposure to the human populations and had a significant impact in terms of the food supply system in Europe. Well, let's talk briefly here about the comparative toxicology of dioxins in terms of controlled animal studies that have been studied over the past several decades in terms of identifying some of the risk vectors and risk assessment of dioxin toxicosis. We find that the syndrome induced by the chlorinated dibenzodioxins in a given species of animal is comparative to that induced by the dibenzofurans, the PCBs, the polybrominated biphenyls, or chlorinated naphthalenes. And so there seems to be the same sort of pattern of toxic progression regardless of the specific chemical. The pathogenesis of the disease is the same. It suggests that these chemicals involve the same receptors. Typical exposure of these chemicals, as we find it in nature in the food system, typically includes a mixture of isomers and compounds, and that yields our toxicity equivalent structure in terms of risk assessment. So it is best to view this whole disease as a chlorinated hydrocarbon disease syndrome in terms of its etiology rather than a specific insult from a particular chemical. What we find is the syndrome varies from animal species to animal species. The skin of primates and rabbits, cattle and some mice show this characteristic chloracne or follicular dermatitis. The livers of chicken, this is a hepatotoxic chemical. Livers of chickens, rabbits show some necrotic response of lethal severity. We see this in some guinea pigs, cattle, non-human primates. We find enlarged liver, epithelial hyperplasia, the bile duct and gallbladder. So there is acute hepatotoxicity. Some animals show epithelial lesions in the entire GI tract and the renal system as well. The one organ that we find in terms of this presentation of the syndrome that shows lesions in all species is the thymus. Often it's significantly reduced, about 25% in size in lethal intoxications. It seems to have an impact in terms of the immunotoxic aspects of these chlorinated organic compounds. Remember that the thymus is where the formation of lymphocytes happens and important in terms of antibody function and immune properties of the organism. A severe intoxication in birds is accompanied by a fluid accumulation, this chick edema that the veterinarians observed in the Belgium incident. It's interesting to note that the total dose of TCDD required to produce disease is less if the dose is spread over time than in a single dose. And there seems to be some bioactivation in terms of the metabolic profile and the toxicologic outcome if, in fact, for a toxic dose. Now, in terms of looking at toxic doses, the LD50 for a range of species, pigs are most sensitive, and this is in micrograms per kilogram. So this is of TCDD in controlled studies, 0.6 parts per billion. Avian species are very sensitive. Rat species, 22 to 45. Mice, on the order of 100 to 200 parts per billion. Rhesus monkeys, less than 70. Rabbits, 115. And hamsters at 5,000 parts per billion. This gives you an indication of some of the concerns in terms of comparative toxicology that among test animal species, there is an 4 orders of magnitude variability in the LD50. Where are humans in this? Typically what we do, as you well know, is we apply safety factors to the most sensitive species. And therefore, that gives us some of the concerns in terms of risk assessment and risk modeling in humans associated with dioxins. Some of the observations we have from animal studies that young animals and females may be more susceptible to intoxication. This has to do with field observations and not necessarily observations in particular dose response lab studies. What we find is that neonatal death and poor survival of the young female, infertility and reproductive failure are some indicators of field-associated dioxin exposures. What we find is that at lethal dose, the time between exposure and death is unusually long. In the guinea pig, we find that it can be 2 to 3 weeks, and so there is a clinical progression of disease. There apparently is biochemical and biomolecular interruptions. In the monkey, the time from lethal dose to lethality to death is 6 weeks. What we find is that except for animals with severe hepatotoxicity and liver necrosis, those are chickens and rabbits, the cause of death is not usually attributed to a specific organ or a specific system pathology. In general, what we find is that animals exhibit a wasting disease associated with these chlorinated hydrocarbons. It resembles starvation and anorexia, so there's obviously a nutritional transport and absorption impact associated with chlorinated hydrocarbons. In some of the environmental exposures, the disease is very complicated by the opportunistic infections that are associated with the immunotoxic profiles of dioxins. In terms of the metabolic profile of TCDD, we've got some of this from dog and rat studies. The major metabolites of biotransformation are phase 1 hydroxylated compounds. Most of these compounds are eliminated as the parent compound in feces. The chronic rodent bioassays, life-term and short-term animal studies have addressed some of the issues of tumor initiation, promotion, co-carcinogenesis, DNA interaction, mutagenesis, and clastogenesis associated with TCDD. This is a very well-studied chemical compound studied on the macro organism level and also on the biomolecular level. In terms of its carcinogenicity, mutagenicity profile, in terms of the animals here in rat and mouse data, you see a dose response indication here in terms of the dose of tetrachlorodibenzodioxin, and this is micrograms per kilogram per day. As we increase the dose from 0.01 to 0.1, we see the increase in tumors from hepatocellular squamous cell carcinoma. In mice, same sort of thing, a tenfold increase in dose from 0.03 micrograms per kilogram per day to 0.3. we see hepatocellular tumors, thyroid tumors developing in the test species. Some of the suggested mechanisms of toxicity and carcinogenicity associated with dioxins include alteration of the cell membrane function and cell-to-cell communication. There can be an effect on vitamin A function, some potential for membrane lipid peroxidation from free radicals generated in the biotransformation of the chemical, an impact on thyroid hormones, an impact to the thyroid itself, hormone alterations associated with thyroid dysfunction and estrogenic effects, and as well a modification of DNA. Some experiments have suggested that the production of superoxide initiates a peroxidation effect that allows for progressive hepatotoxicity. What we find is that TCDD does inhibit hepatic selenium glutathione peroxidase and reduce glutathione. There apparently, from laboratory studies, is a good correlation between glutathione peroxidase activity and survival of the organism. There is, for example, a lipid peroxidation endpoint that's been observed in the biotransformation and organ impact of these chemicals. Now, if we look at the molecular level profile, when people have studied this, and this is ongoing research, people have looked at perhaps modeling and analyzing some of the cellular changes in vitro work on dioxin impacts to particular cells and cellular processes. We find 14 steps that are listed on this particular slide in terms of diffusion into the cell, binding with the aryl hydrocarbon receptor protein, dissociation from heat shock protein 90, active translocation into the cytoplasm, and that's associated with a hydrocarbon nuclear translocator protein, conversion of a receptor to enhancer DNA, altered DNA configuration, histone modification, recruitment of additional protein in terms of a cyclic effect, nucleosome disruption, increased accessibility of transcriptional promoter, and then binding to various factors of the promoter, and then enhanced messenger RNA and protein synthesis being some of the early molecular events. Again, some of the challenges in terms of interpreting these in vitro studies is differentiating essentially molecular adaptation or biomolecular adaptation, cellular adaptation to a chemical and the presentation of an adverse effect. This table is from EPA, and this gives you a broad matrix of the effects of TCDD and related compounds in various species. I'll let you examine this in terms of the class notes. Some of the effects across species for enzyme induction, lethality, wasting, teratogenesis, mortality, endocrine effects, immunotoxicity, carcinogenicity, neurotoxicity, porphyria, and hepatotoxicity, most of those being observed in humans with the exception in terms of broad-based clinical endpoints of lethality. Now, if we switch over now in terms of examining kind of the sources and pathways in terms of human exposure, we find that an analysis of environmental source types that combustion and incineration sources are the primary release vector for dioxins in the environment. We do have industry-specific vectors, including metal smelting, refining, and processing, various chemical manufacturing and processing, especially those chemicals associated with organochlorinated compounds. We find that we do have reservoir sources such as soils that do experience atmospheric deposition, and also some of the molecular and microbial bioprocesses associated with natural production of some dioxin compounds, a minor resource. As well, there are biological and photochemical processes associated with dioxin production. Over the past decade and a half, 15 years or so, there has been a significant upbeat in regulatory pressure by various industries and dischargers to limit releases of dioxins. In terms of quantifying these TEQs, or toxicity equivalents of dioxins and furans in the U.S., you can see as you go down this list from incinerations being one of, again, the prime vectors, the various incineration sources from municipal waste to cremation and funeral parlors, hazardous materials, combustion, and even cigarettes, that there is has been a decrease from 1987 observations to 1995 observations, and this has been a significant decrease. In terms of power energy generation, in terms of the decreased concentrations of chlorinated hydrocarbons and therefore dioxins from the combustion of various fuels, including wood combustion and coal combustion, and again because of enhanced recognition of the sources and the pathways of dioxin production, and as well the limitation of airborne release in terms of new technologies for cleaning smoke discharges. You see across this list fairly significant decreases in dioxin release over 1987 to 1995. Overall, this gives us a release to air in terms of the total quantified releases to air, a reduction in terms of the grams of TEQ per year in the U.S. This is grams across the nation, 13,000 grams being released in 1987 of these equivalent compounds down to 2,700. This is a significant response in terms of enhanced regulatory pressure. This response has actually been observed in terms of a lowering of human body burden levels as well, as we'll see in a moment. Some of the releases to water in terms of point of discharge for particular industries, many chlorinated compounds are used in paper bleaching in wool pulp and paper mills. There's been significant regulatory pressure applied to limit the releases of dioxin-like compounds from paper pulp and paper mills. In 1987, 356 grams of TEQ per year down to 19. So in terms of source abatement, this has been a significant source abatement result. In terms of releases to land, the grams of TEQs per year again shows a very similar sort of range due to enhanced regulatory pressure in some aspects, primarily with regulated industries, the pulp and paper mills. Municipal treated sludge has not shown a change, but in terms of the production of 2,4-D herbicide, a very commonly used herbicide, and removing it as a byproduct of manufacturing, there has been a small change there. Overall, a small decrease in quantifiable releases in terms of grams per TEQ per year. It's not on the same order of magnitude of reduction, but it's also not on the same order of magnitude of release as incineration. In terms of quantifying the overall releases, and again, the biggest segment is in incineration and combustion sources, in terms of releases of grams of TEQs per year, in 1987, 13,500, 1995, 2,800. So significant regulatory success story in terms of the application of pressure that we as citizens through our elected officials and then regulatory governmental agencies put to play in terms of industrial releases of these types of chemicals. Now, if we take a look at the other sorts of sources that we have in terms of our environment, we have some uncontrolled combustion sources, metal smelting, chemical manufacturing, biological and photochemical processes, for example, in composting. There are some also reservoir sources out into the environment. All of these contribute to our dioxin load, but they're unquantified. So between 1987 and 1995, via regulatory pressure, we had an 80% decrease of sources of dioxins and release to air, water, and land. This is primarily due to municipal and medical waste incineration release reductions. This had a lot to do with new regulations, new knowledge about the risk of dioxins from toxicologists, from risk assessors, and the risk management aspect of somehow delinking the cycle between production of dioxins, contamination of the food system, and impacts on the U.S. population. The Clean Air Act, in terms of the vehicle for control, the regulatory control, the Clean Air Act, requires emissions based on a maximum control, achievable control technology. This challenged it in terms of gave the regulators the authority to limit release. The Clean Air Act and RCRA, the Resources Conservation Recovery Act, allowed for management of hazardous waste incinerators that had the potential to release dioxins. The Clean Water Act managed release in terms of the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, or NPDES, which is the end-of-pipe permit for a pipe that discharges into natural waters. The Clean Water Act gives us an ambient water quality standard for TCDD, and this is a guidance for the development of state water quality criteria. Pulp and paper facilities were the largest known industrial discharges of dioxin into water, and the Clean Water Act guidelines in the late 1990s actually helped reduce discharge from pulp or paper facilities, and this is projected to be as much as 96% reduction. This has a lot to do with enhanced controls in terms of the release, but also an effort to change the types of bleaching chemicals used in the pulp and paper industry. In terms of the various water releases, there is a maximum contaminant goal of zero in terms of releasing contaminants into water systems. The Safe Water Drinking Water Act enforces a maximum contaminant level of 3 × 10⁻⁸ parts per million for TCDD as well in terms of human drinking water in municipal or regulated systems. The control efforts for land have to do with Superfund and RCRA cleanups and management of hazardous waste, things like Times Beach and Love Canal incidents. The hazardous waste identification disposal rules under RCRA help prevent future contamination by establishing rules for proper legal hazardous waste management. The Toxic Substances Control Act, or TSCA, authorizes restricted use of dioxin-contaminated pulp and paper sludge. And so there is more emphasis on the pulp and paper industries to remove dioxin, potential dioxin-forming processes from their industrial processes. And there is also an effort to limit the amount of dioxin released from cement kilns, which make cement that we use in construction. FIFRA also has, and TSCA also authorized control and limitation of some of these chemicals. And so the manufacturing processes for manufacturer of some chemicals like 2,4-5-T and pentachlorophenol, which have been used for their herbicidal activity and as wood treatment, have actually been banned by use, and therefore the potential of those compounds to contribute via combustion or by other environmental processes to the dioxin load has been eliminated. In terms of the environmental media of where TEQ concentrations come from, we find in rural soils, again, soils that aren't impacted as much by industrial processes. These are 1 to 6 picograms per gram or part per trillion. In urban soils, significantly higher, as many perhaps as 3 times higher. In sediments of some water bodies, 1 to 60 picograms per gram or parts per trillion. And again, the impact of rural versus urban area, significant more concentration and therefore exposure in urban air, typically due to increased human activity and combustion sources. One of the major endpoints in terms of dioxins cycling through the environment is contamination of the food system. What we find is that this yields levels, especially as we look at the lipophilic nature of these chemicals, and it's cycling in the liposphere that is going to present in food products that have higher levels of fat. The total picograms of TEQs of dioxins and furans per gram of fresh weight food is given in this list for beef, pork, eggs, milk, dairy products, freshwater fish with a significant concentration because of the deposition pathway, marine shellfish, vegetable fats, and water being not large enough to contribute in a substantial way. We do generally see higher levels for confined animals, typically confined animals that are near urban areas. In terms of the percent contribution of food dioxin intake for children, the National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine report analyzed all manners of dioxin exposure to different age groups, including adults. This is a segment of that report, but it gives you an idea that when people have done the exposure assessment for children 1 to 5 years based on dietary consumption of certain food types, when you break that down in terms of specific loading, you find that in fact the largest segment is 35% from meat, second largest from dairy foods and mixtures of dairy foods at 30%, and the next two down are associated with consumption of fruits and vegetables and other sorts of components in the food diet. In terms of the background and body burden changes across the term where this enhanced dioxin regulation happened, in the late 1980s, the body burden was 30 to 80 picograms TEQs per gram of lipid, so 30 to 80 parts per trillion in human body fat. The midpoint was about 55 picograms of TEQ, and this included all dioxins, furans, and dioxin-like PCBs. The high-end estimates in terms of the scope or the range of populations, and this is about 1% of the general population, may be as much as three times higher, and this is based on consumption of high-fat diets as a surrogate for dioxin intake. In the late 1990s, this had decreased so that on a lipid basis, we now had 25 parts per trillion, so a significant decrease in terms of the release to the environment and the cycling through the human food chain, a significant regulatory success once again. Well, finally, in terms of looking at dioxins in the human food chain, we are challenged with coming up with a risk profile, especially at these very, very low levels. What we find is that receptor binding and some of these early biochemical events are likely to demonstrate low-dose linearity, but taking that low-dose linearity to a biologically based cancer model is a challenge. If it in fact does link up in terms of cancer slope factors, then that risk will be linear to the exposure of TCDD at low doses. But still, we just don't have a good handle on all of the mechanistic relationships associated with low-dose impacts, metabolic impacts, and its relation to human disease. Our dose response curve in terms of low-dose exposure to dioxins has a significant amount of uncertainty. We have then uncertainty in the whole risk assessment of these very low doses in terms of our response in terms of risk management, risk mitigation associated with dioxins in the human food supply. So hopefully this has given you a good briefing, an in-depth briefing, if you will, without going to the primary literature associated with dioxins in the human food chain. The D word does in fact stimulate a lot of discussion in many circles. Because of its acute toxicity in some animal species and its potential for human impact in terms of metabolic disorders and human disease. Hopefully this gives you an idea of this particular type of chemical compound, but also related chemical compounds in terms of these chlorinated hydrocarbons in the human food chain. Until next time, we'll see you again. Thanks so much.